विशेष शून्यवादि पाश्कुचार्य सिद्धाने वंदे हम श्री गुरु श्री युता पर कमलम श्री गुरुन वैष्णवंश्च श्री रूपम साग्रजातम सहगना रघुनाथम वितम सम सजीवम सद्वैतम सद्वदूतम हरिजना सहिता कृष्ण चैतन्य देवम श्री राधा कृष्ण पदम सहगना रविता श्री विशाखम वितमश्च पंचकल्पतरुभिश्चापि वसुदेवेभ्यः पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
July 24th, 2015 Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text 10. Parashtaresham Bhagavan Vratani. Shrutani me vyasa mukhara bhikshnam. Atripnumakshula sukhavahanam.
Atripnumakshula sukhavahanam.
Tesham rite krishna katam ritognat.
Okay, we all set? Thank you.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Oh my Lord, I have repeatedly heard about these higher and lower statuses of human society from the mouth of Vyasadeva, and I've had enough of all these lesser subject matters and their happiness. They have not satisfied me with the nectar of topics about Krishna. Purport. Because people are very much interested in hearing social and political presentations, Srila Vyasadeva has compiled many books, such as the Puranas and Mahabharatas. These books are reading matter for the mass of people, and they were compiled with a view to reviving their God consciousness, now forgotten in the conditional life of material existence. The real purpose of such literatures is not so much to present topics of historical references, but to revive the people's sense of God consciousness. For example, Mahabharata is the history of the Battle of Kurukshetra, and common people read it because it is full of topics regarding the social, political, and economic problems of human society. But factually, the most important part of the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita, which is automatically taught to readers, along with the historical narrations of the Battle of Kurukshetra. Vidura explained to Maitreya his position of being fully satiated with the knowledge of mundane social and political topics and having no more interest in them. He was anxious to hear transcendental topics regarding Lord Sri Krishna. Because there were insufficient topics directly concerning Krishna in the Puranas, Mahabharata, etc., he was not satisfied and wanted to know more about Krishna. Krishna Katha, or topics regarding Krishna, are transcendental, and there is no satiation in hearing such topics. Bhagavad Gita is important on account of its being Krishna Katha, or speeches delivered by Lord Krishna. The story of the Battle of Kurukshetra may be interesting for the mass of people, but to a person like Vidura, who is highly advanced in devotional service, only Krishna Katha and that which is dovetailed with Krishna Katha is interesting. Vidura wanted to hear of everything from Maitreya, and so he inquired from him, but he desired that all the topics be in relationship with Krishna. As fire is never satisfied in its consummation of firewood, so a pure devotee of the Lord never hears enough about Krishna. Historical events and other narrations concerning social and political incidents all become transcendental as soon as they are in relationship with Krishna. That is the way to transform mundane things into spiritual identity. The whole world can be transformed into Vaikuntha if all worldly activities are dovetailed with Krishna Katha. There are two important Krishna Kathas current in the world, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavad Gita is Krishna Katha because it is spoken by Krishna, whereas Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna Katha because it narrates about Krishna. Lord Chaitanya advised all his disciples to preach Krishna Katha all over the world without discrimination, because the transcendental value of Krishna Katha can purify one and all from material contamination. Paravaresham Bhagavan Vritani Shrutani Me Vyasa Mukada Bhikshnam Atripnunakshula Sukha Vahanam Tesham Rite Krishna Katam Ritagat. O my Lord, I have repeatedly heard about these higher and lower statuses of human society from the mouth of Vyasadeva, and I've had enough of these lesser subject matters and their happiness. They have not satisfied me with the nectar of topics about Krishna. So we all have, as Prabhupada often states, an innate desire to hear about others' activities. It's something that's intrinsic to us as a soul. And therefore we find that all over the world, people are always interested in hearing about the activities of others. You know, a long time ago, I mean, maybe not that long ago, people would do this by reading the newspapers. Prabhupada tells that story of the Christian missionary who went to the miners and said, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. And when they said, what is hell like? He said, oh, it's dark and cold. And that didn't affect them because they worked in the dark and cold mines all the time. And then when he said, well, there's no newspapers, they said, oh, horrible. Then we don't want to go there. No way do we want to go someplace where there is no newspapers. So it used to be that people would sit around reading the newspapers. You know, nowadays people want to blame smartphones and tablets for separating people. But before there were smartphones and tablets, people were sitting at breakfast. The typical scenario was the husband and wife are sitting at breakfast reading their newspapers. And all they see is the newspapers. You go on the train, the bus, and everybody was there with the newspapers. So now they're reading it electronically. And now, of course, electronically, there's so much more than you could get, right? You used to have to buy a newspaper, a limited number of pages. And now you could spend 24 hours a day reading all of the mundane topics for free on the internet. I guess you have to pay for your internet connection, but you know, on and on and on and on and on. You could read about every nuance of every celebrity and wannabe celebrity and every politician and anything about history, geography, sociology, politics, and so on. And, of course, before even the newspapers, before electronic media, before the newspapers, so people would gather at some place to talk about village talk, Gramya Katha. And in almost every town there was some place, usually the men and women would gather separately. You still see this in some places, although it's not so common anymore, that there's some store where early in the morning the men are gathered around and they're having something to eat or drink and they're talking about social, political, historical, etc. And then there's some place where the women are gathering. Maybe they're gathering at the well or again at the grocery store or the market. And they're talking about, either they're talking about on the big scene, you know, nowadays the world has become very small. So nowadays people are gossiping about some movie star they've never met in a far off country or the affairs of some country that they've never gone to and never will go to. And used to be they would talk about just in the village, who's getting married to whom in the village. I remember when the prince and duchess in the UK had their first baby, so it was big news everywhere. And I read one satire that was saying, you know, a mature married woman in her fertile years just gave birth to a baby, so what? You know, but this was the kind of thing people were talking about. If they weren't talking about it, about the royalty or the movie stars or the politicians, then they were talking about it about their neighbor. Oh, you know, so-and-so had a baby, so-and-so's engaged, so-and-so's getting married, so-and-so died, so-and-so got sick, so-and-so did this, so-and-so did that. And this is our tendency. We want to hear something, and we especially want to hear a story. We want to hear some exciting story with some conflict and some adventure in all the different tastes. We want to hear stories of heroism and charity and religiousness. We want to hear funny stories. We want to hear sad stories. We want to hear ghastly, horrible stories and scary ones and full of wonder and excitement, full of romance, full of friendship, of serving, of wonder. All of these, this is what we're hankering to hear. But we have a big problem. We really have a big problem, and this is what Vidura is saying here. He's saying, Atripnuna, I'm not satisfied. Trishta is about being satisfied. And he says, I'm not satisfied with Shula. He says, Abhikshnam, repeatedly I have heard, but Atripnuna, I am unsatisfied. Shula Sukha, I'm not satisfied with this little tiny bit of happiness. And this is our experience. So we hear about this or that or the other, or maybe in the society of devotees, we mostly gossip about the other devotees as if we're a small village. Who took sannyas, who fell down from sannyas, etc., etc. So it's not satisfying. There's some little happiness that one gets, undoubtedly. A drop of water in the desert, there's a little happiness. But it's very unsatisfying. And you could spend, as I say, today with electronic media, it's very easy to spend all day just hearing about the ordinary katha, gramya katha. But at the end, there's no sense of unlimited joy. No matter how much one reads about the economy or political or wars or romance, we don't end up with some sort of joy. We don't end up with exaltation. And yet, because the desire is in our heart as a soul to hear wonderful stories about wonderful people, if we don't know about Krishna, we'll keep hearing about mundane people and being satiated, being unsatisfied. I like how Prabhupada uses the word satiated and satisfaction. With this material hearing, we get satiated but not satisfied. Very much like my granddaughter just came home from a trip to the mainland of the U.S. where she was doing a lot of Bharatanatyam dancing, and she said that the main food that they were eating was pizza. She said practically all the time people were just buying pizza, which is interesting. She was mostly with Indians, mostly from South India. But anyway, she also had a lot of Italy's. But she said they had a lot of pizza. And then she said she went to visit one devotee's house, and they said, would you like us to make some pizza? And she's like, no more pizza. So that's what happens with material pleasure. You become satiated. You say, that's enough. I don't want any more. I need a break. As bhoga tyaga. It actually becomes, at a certain point, revolting. You know, if you really indulge, if you were to spend all day just reading about the movie stars and the politicians, then you'd become disgusted. It says this in the Bhagavatam. It says that a small amount of ghee will inflame a fire, but a large amount of ghee can put it out. So when you have when you become saturated with all this mundane katha, you just become disgusted. So that's not happiness. It doesn't satisfy you in the moment. It doesn't bring unlimited pleasure in the moment. And then you become satiated. You become, say you have enough, and even you become disgusted. And yet, because we have this desire to hear about others, we find it very difficult to stop. You know, and of course nowadays not only is there talk about real people, but there's so much fiction. Of course, fiction in and of itself is not wrong. Even the Bhagavatam has some fiction, the Puranjana story, the forest of material enjoyment, and so forth. Fiction in and of itself isn't wrong if fiction is teaching truth. But nowadays, there's practically not only unlimited talk about the politicians and the movie stars and the athletes, but there's also practically unlimited fiction. Right? You can watch TV and movies, again, 24 hours. You wouldn't be able to come to the end of it. And the problem is that even though we become satiated and dissatisfied, because we have such a desire in the heart for katha, we may end up getting involved in this gramya katha. So what's the problem with that? Well, aside from being satiated and unsatisfied, which I would think is enough of a problem in itself, doing something that you crave more and more because you're not satisfied and you hate more and more because you're satiated, wanting more and more of something that gives you less and less pleasure. So if that isn't enough of a problem, it sounds like a drug addiction, doesn't it? Wanting more and more of something that gives you less and less pleasure. In addition to that, when we are hearing this Gramya-katha, ordinary katha, we become entangled in the cycle of birth and death. So this morning I was just reading in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita how whatever we think about at the time of death determines our next body. And what do we think about? We think about what absorbs us, what attracts us, what promises us some sort of rasa, what promises us some sort of enjoyment. And the promise of maya, by definition, is false. Maya is full of, that's what maya means. Maya means false promises. But we're still hoping, like the donkey following the carriage. And so then we take another birth to become involved in this satiation but no satisfaction business, being absorbed in the illusory affairs of conditioned souls, or the illusions of the illusions, made-up stories, and so forth. So what's our cure for this? Okay, well, our cure for this is to be absorbed in the reality. That's the only cure. There's no other cure. If we want to get rid of the false thing, we have to have the real thing. And that, of course, is the whole process of bhakti. Bhakti yoga is the process of substituting the real thing for the false thing. And when we have the real thing, then our interest and attraction for the false thing naturally goes away. Of course, as Srila Prabhupada has told us, and as most of us practically experience, that is something that happens gradually and proportionally. So sometimes the first time, when one first comes to Krishna consciousness, the taste of Krishna consciousness is so exciting that one immediately gives up all Gramya-katha. But we find, generally speaking, we find that people are not able to maintain that. And then they have to go kind of go back to their real level and progress in a gradual way. So how are we going to come to the point that we're saturated with Gramya-katha? Gramya-katha is just the opposite. It brings satisfaction without satiation. So material life has satiation without satisfaction, and spiritual life has satisfaction without satiation. And Prabhupada very clearly makes that point here in so many places, that one can go on hearing more and more and more. And we experience this. We experience that. You can read the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, over and over, and there's always something new. There's always something fresh. I mean, how many times can you read Shakespeare or whatever? How many times can you watch some, you know, movie? It becomes stale. But Krishna consciousness is always fresh. That's our practical experience. So how do we get there? How do we get from absorption in what doesn't satisfy us and ties us to this birth and death to absorption in the real? So it's very interesting. Krishna's instructions in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam to Uddhava, where in chapter 28, text 9, he says, Tavat karmani kurvita na nirvidyetayavata matkata shravana dauva shradayavanna jayate. So matkata, Krishna is talking about, again, Krishna kata, like Vidura is speaking about in this verse. And it's interesting that in this verse 11:29, Krishna is saying that one should perform the pious activities given in the Vedas until one gains faith, and after faith, a taste. So this is one explanation of the process, that first one gets oneself in sattva guna. And we find that the lifestyle that Srila Prabhupada and our Vaishnava Acharyas have given us. Indeed, we can say that in any genuine religious system, there's this very similar lifestyle, is meant to bring one to sattva guna. Waking up early in the morning, for example. So we find religious people, again, of any religious persuasion, will wake up early in the morning. Why? Because in the morning, first the modes are in equilibrium, and then the sattva guna is very present. And spending the morning time doing things in sattva guna or in transcendence. So, especially the five most potent items of devotional service, Srila Prabhupada packed it into ISKCON's morning program. So you go to a holy place, you go to a temple, or you have a temple in your home, an altar in your home. You worship the deity, you chant the holy name, you read the shastra, and you associate with other devotees. And you do this during the time of sattva guna. Something like the other day, we went to the farmer's market in the middle of the day, my daughter and I was saying to her, yeah, I've never seen this kind of traffic here in Hilo. And we realized, oh, we're out at everybody's lunchtime in downtown, the farmer's market's open. So when you try to go someplace during rush hour, it's very difficult to move forward. You know, you eventually get to your destination, but with much difficulty and very slowly. But if you travel exactly the same route at another time of the day, I mean, if I were to go downtown now, it would be very quick. There would be nobody on the roads. So there's different times that are conducive for different things. And the early morning is very conducive for any sattva guna activity or any spiritual transcendent activity. Of course, transcendental activities can be done at any time. They're not limited by the modes of nature. They're not really, they have nothing to do really with the modes of material nature. They're transcendental to them. At the same time, the mode of sattva, even though it's also a material mode, is very conducive to transcendental activities. It's much easier to perform transcendental activities when the situation is in sattva. And then, you know, a general lifestyle in sattva all the time, not just in the morning. This is why we have these four regulative principles. You know, if somebody wants to be in sattva guna, but they're taking intoxication, how is that going to happen? You know, just like one devotee said to me the other day, well, I can understand why people want to take intoxication. They don't like their current state of mind, and so they want to experience another state of mind. Well, that's understandable, but we should experience another state of mind by tapasya, by meditation, not just with some chemical. So if you want to try to get another state of mind with some chemical, you may become fooled and think, oh, you know, now I'm seeing God, now I'm... But it's not real. It's a semblance. It's a shadow. And one may think, take some drug, some alcohol, and one may think, oh, I'm great, I'm powerful. But it's not real. You know, it's a cheap... Intoxication is a cheap way of trying to come to a higher consciousness. And it doesn't actually do it. In fact, it brings you to a lower consciousness. And it removes the desire to come to a higher consciousness. Because you think, well, now I've already attained it. Right? And gambling is another way of trying to get something cheaply. Instead of doing honest labor according to one's propensity, one just thinks, oh, I'll do some quick game and make a quick buck in some cheating way without any exchange of goods and services. And illicit sex is the same thing. You know, marriage is hard. You have to sacrifice for your spouse. You have to take care of the children. You have to have a livelihood, you have to maintain a house, and then you can enjoy sex with your spouse. But people, no, I don't want to do that. So much trouble to maintain the spouse, so much trouble to maintain it. So let me just have illicit sex. Let me just engage in, what did Prabhupada call it? Artificial means, right? The whole pornography industry is so huge now that people you know, imagine that they're having sex with the person on the stage when they're just having sex with themselves. You know, or they get into a relationship with another human being, but just to take from them, not to give anything to them. Let me just take the pleasure without the sacrifice. So all of those, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling, are all about trying to get some happiness without actually earning it. And therefore, the happiness you get is not real happiness. It's artificial. It's superficial. And it doesn't bring about the ability to understand God, because one cannot understand God without sacrifice, because understanding God requires love, and love requires sacrifice. Sarvagatam brahma nitya yagya pratisthitam. And then meat-eating removes one's ability to be in sattva-guna, because it is such a gross form of taking pleasure through causing others pain. I mean, all conditioned souls take pleasure through causing others pain. All of our pleasure is at the pain of somebody. If you build a house, that you're removing the homes from so many insects and creatures, etc. So there's always like that. That cannot be avoided in the world. But meat eating is such a gross form of it, and such an unnecessary form of it. There's no necessity for eating meat, and it has, meat eating has so many terrible repercussions for the planet and so forth. So giving up these things, meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling, and then in general life, not just waking up early in the morning, and having a life in general where one is treating others with respect, where one is kind to others, where is one is equal poised, and so forth. This is necessary. One has to come to sattva-guna. And by sattva-guna, one develops faith, as Krishna says in 11:29, why does one develop faith through sattva-guna? Because one starts to see things honestly. Devotee was just telling me this the other day. She said, you know, as I live a more Krishna-conscious life and I chant Hare Krishna, she says, my understanding of things has changed. She said, I no longer think that I'm always right, and I know I have a different perspective on what's happening in my life. So as one lives a lifestyle in sattva-guna and one practices Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, one gets faith. One starts to experience Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharma. One starts to experience that Krishna consciousness is real. I mean, after all, why should one, even if one is satiated and not satisfied with regular katha, why should one hear about Krishna unless one has faith in him? One won't do it. One will think, oh, this is just some Indian mythology, it's just some imaginary story, you know, 12-mile-long witches and huge snakes that swallow boys and all this sort of stuff, driving chariots with horses beyond the universe. Why should I hear about that kind of thing? You know, let me hear about the latest football star instead. But one develops faith because one directly experiences that it's true. One directly experiences that the modes of material nature are true, and that we're different from this body is true, and that Krishna is real is true. All these truths become manifested in the heart. And then one starts to really relish Krishna Katha. Now, it's interesting that although Krishna Katha gives satisfaction without satiation, unless one is somewhat purified, you don't experience it. And of course, Rupa Goswami explains this very nicely, this principle very nicely, in the Upadeshamrita, where he talks about that if you have jaundice, when you eat sugar, it tastes bitter to you. You don't experience it as sugar. I mean, we all experience, even when we have an ordinary cold and we can't smell, that food doesn't taste very good. You know, we can't enjoy the taste of the food. But what's interesting about jaundice is that sugar is the cure for jaundice. So the sugar that tastes bitter in the beginning becomes the cure, and one starts to relish it. So living a general lifestyle in sattva-guna and engaging in the processes of bhakti, yeah, even in the beginning, it purifies us so that we start to relish Krishna Katha. We start to really enjoy it. It stops being something that we're doing as some sort of ritual, or something that we're doing because the guru said to do, or because we become convinced by logic in the shastra, or because we want to show off our knowledge. Well, Krishna did this and Krishna did that, and I can fill out the trivia questions on a bhakti shastra exam. And it starts to be something that we're doing because Krishna is really so wonderful. Of course, that's going to be there, at least to some extent, even in the beginning. But then it grows more and more and more and more until one is eventually just hearing Krishna Katha. And as one is just hearing Krishna Katha, then naturally all of the ordinary Katha, which gave one satiation but without satisfaction, is pushed away. And eventually there's nothing left for it. Now it's interesting looking here at some very specific things that Vidura says and that Prabhupada says in the purport. He talks about para and avaresham, higher and lower, which Srila Prabhupada translates as, I have repeatedly heard about these higher and lower statuses of human society. So this is a specific type of Gramyakata. And I was thinking on reading this that this type of Gramyakata is particularly present, perhaps it was also in Vidura's time, but it's particularly present at the present time, that, you know, who's higher and who's lower, the struggles between men and women, the struggles between the rich and the poor, between the educated and the uneducated. When we study sociology, we study about different frames of reference for sociology. And one of them is called functionalism, which is the same view of Varnashram, and definitely the view of society that Srila Prabhupada had. And that is that each person, regardless of their higher or lower status from one perspective, has their function in society, and each function in society is equally applicable to spiritual life and equally glorious. So we may say that the brahmanas, as the head of society, are most important, but, you know, you really wouldn't want to lose your legs. I mean, I don't think anybody would say, well, I want to lose my legs. And it's the shudra that provide all the beauty in society and the shudras that provide all the functions in society. Without the shudras, there's no garbage pickup, there's no roads, there's no water system. You know, there's nothing that makes society function. So it's not a question then of higher or lower. I mean, do we really say that the people who pick up the garbage are less important to the society than the professors in the university? I mean, from one perspective, you could say it's more important to get your garbage picked up, I suppose. So the other views, the other sociological views, see things in terms of conflict. They're called conflict theory. And conflict theory can look at things through the either through class or through gender, usually. So either they're looking at social classes, who's higher, who's lower, or they look at gender, who's higher and who's lower. Of course, one can also look in terms of races. You know, are the Asian people, are they better than the Caucasians? Are the Caucasians better than the black Africans? You know, are the East Indians better than the Chinese? And you can look at, you know, who's better than whom. I know of one devotee who was writing me messages just for weeks and weeks and weeks about Prabhupada's statements about various groups being higher or lower. But really, this is not our lens. Prabhupada says in the 20th chapter of Krishna book, the materialists see the world as very aggressive and the devotee sees everything as happily situated. So we want to get out of this thing of this friends and enemies and higher and lower and who's better, and it's sort of ridiculous. The other thing that really jumped out at me from this purport is Srila Prabhupada talking about that we can dovetail historical and other narrations concerning social and political incidents as soon as they are in relationship with Krishna. So one might legitimately ask, well, if I'm a devotee, does that mean and I get more and more into Krishna Katha and less interested in ordinary Katha, does that mean that I wouldn't know anything about the world? You know, are we looking at a devotee being like an avaduta who's just living at Radhakund and just talking about Rasalila all the time and has no idea who's the president of America or what war is going on or whatever? You know, are we all meant to be like that? Well, we see that Srila Prabhupada wasn't like that. Rupa Sanatan, Jiva Goswami, they were not like that. Ramananda Roy wasn't like that. Of course, at the end of his manifest pastimes, Lord Chaitanya was like that. But Lord Chaitanya wasn't like that in general. And when I was in Manipur a couple years ago, the devotees put on a wonderful traditional dance drama traditional Manipuri dance, traditional Manipuri music. It was all in the Manipur language, so I thankfully had a translator next to me. But it was about the history, the political history of the state of Manipur. But it was also all about Krishna, because the kings of Manipur were all devotees of Krishna. And it was just wonderful to watch and hear this historical, political narration of wars and so forth. That was all related to Krishna. One didn't have to give up anything because there was Krishna everywhere. And of course, this is what's being discussed in the purport. The problem is when one gets into these things with Krishna just on the side, and Vidura is saying, you know, I really want intense Krishna. I really want intense Krishna. So we should be finding ourselves falling in love with talks about Krishna. We should find ourselves really relishing the shastras, not reading them as some sort of ritual or reading them just for knowledge or, you know, reading them and forgetting what we read 5 minutes later, but really relishing them. And if we find that we still have a lot of attraction for ordinary katha and we don't have so much relishment of Krishna, then we need to look at our lives. And are we living lives in sattva guna that will give us the faith to become absorbed in this Krishna katha? So thank you very much. Anyone have questions, comments?
If you can speak a little bit louder.
Okay, can I go out?
Yes.
Yeah, now it's good.
Thank you very much for the nice class, Mataji. I was specifically curious about this, which you said that about hearing, because generally we relate hearing from the authority for getting the right information. But as I remember in the second chapter of the first canto, hearing is also about purification. So can you elaborate about this purification process of the hearing, from the hearing? Because what you focus was on purification through the lifestyle.
Yes, well, our lifestyle includes hearing. Of course, without a pure lifestyle, it's very hard to get purified by hearing. These things are complementary. I was just hearing Srila Prabhupada say that we don't even tell people about a purified lifestyle until they've gotten purified somewhat by hearing. However, without a purified lifestyle, it's very difficult to progress past a certain point. You know, you can come to the platform of Adushraddha and Sadhu Sangha without a purified lifestyle. But if you want to get on to Nista and Ruchi and Ashakti, you have to do Bhajana Kriya. So certainly hearing purifies us. There's no doubt about it. But to get deeply into hearing a purified lifestyle, we're not going to say it's absolutely essential, but we're going to say, generally speaking, for most people, it's absolutely essential. I mean, there could be somebody that just by hearing immediately jumps from tamagun to transcendence. I mean, it happens. It's possible. But generally speaking, after we have our initial attraction from hearing, we want to have a more purified lifestyle. The hearing itself gets our desire for a more purified lifestyle, and it's the purified lifestyle that really aids in the hearing having some effect. Without the purified lifestyle, the hearing doesn't have much effect. It doesn't... It's like Jesus talked about, you try to plant seeds in different kinds of ground. You know, you may go to a... We've been buying some plants. You know, you can go to a garden shop and you can get very attracted by the plant in the pot. And you say, all right, let me bring it home and plant it. But if you don't water it, if you don't fertilize it, it's not going to progress past that initial stage and it may die. So initially our attraction to hearing, for sure. And it's our pure lifestyle is not what's purifying us, but it's providing the proper ground for Krishna consciousness to flourish. Is that all right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mother Mila, could you please explain when you say that at a certain time of day, the modes are in equilibrium, and then there's a predominance of goodness. Now, what does that mean? Why equilibrium? Because that, to me, when I hear the word, it means that all the other modes are present.
Well, all the modes are always present. You're not going to have any place in the material world where there's absolutely no ignorance or even absolutely no goodness. There's some mixture of the modes. And as Krishna says in the Gita, they're always vying for supremacy. But I learned that when I was studying Ayurveda. I had some high school students who wanted to learn Ayurveda. And in order to teach it to them, I had to study it myself. So I didn't get beyond a very basic level. But I did find out, I mean, for me, the most interesting thing about studying Ayurveda was seeing that everything that Prabhupada taught us had some basis in Ayurvedic science. And I found that totally fascinating. So according to Ayurveda, the modes are dominant at different times of the day, at different times of the year, at different times in our life. So each of us has, depending on our particular body and mind, which is a particular combination of the modes, the atmosphere resonates with us in a particular way. So just like if somebody's very much in the mode of ignorance, when the mode of goodness is dominant, they just go to sleep. You know, they can't function in the mode of goodness. Anyway, the modes are active more or less. So certain times of the day, the mode of passion is more active. Certain times a day, the mode of ignorance is more active. Otherwise, people or entities in those modes couldn't function. We function best when the modes of the atmosphere resonate with the modes of our body and mind. But there's a certain time of the day when everything is more or less in balance. It's very brief. It's a time right before sunrise when everything is in balance. And that's the best time for transcendence. Then right after that, mode of goodness becomes very dominant, which is also a very good time for transcendence. So Prabhupada had us do the bulk of our spiritual activities during those two times, during the time of equilibrium and during the time of sattva-gun.
I have another question. What about in the purport, it really sounds like, other than Bhagavad Gita, everything else in the Mahabharata would be not satisfying Monday. It's hard to understand because, boy, the Mahabharata is something you not only can't put down, but in my experience, it's better and better every time you hear or read.
Well, you know, frankly, even in the Bhagavatam, there are whole sections of the Bhagavatam. Like if we have, say, Puruva and Urvasi, Agnidra, and Purvachiti, the movements of the planets. So there's whole sections of the Bhagavatam that don't directly seem to be Krishna Katha. You know, sometimes you get one of these verses to speak on that's just describing the parts of a woman's body or something. I mean, you know. So what I see is if one become absorbed in those things separately from Krishna, then they're not of any value. Their value as long as they're connected with the Krishna Katha. And this is a very touchy subject, one where people get very angry. I'll try to make it very brief. Just for gross simplification's sake, there's two main kinds of activities. There's activities which are intrinsically spiritual. The Bhagavatam calls them atmavirya. They have their own potency. And then there are activities which are generally material. However, you can do activities that are intrinsically spiritual materially, and you can do the activities that are generally material spiritually. So as Prabhupada's saying here, if you connect historical and social and political incidents with Krishna, they become spiritualized. And as Prabhupada will say many times, you can do the spiritual activities in a way that you're not getting any spiritual benefit. Prabhupada talks about the professional reciters, and he says there's no benefit for them or their audience, even though they're reciting the Bhagavatam. So I see within the Bhagavatam, look, you can take the aspects of the Bhagavatam that are fully Krishna Katha. You know, these sahajiyas who just read the Rasalila chapters, but instead of becoming purified, Prabhupada says they become putrefied. So it's really about one's consciousness. It's about one's intent. So all of the Mahabharata, as long as we keep the connection with Krishna, is wonderful. All of the Bhagavatam, as long as we keep the connection with Krishna, is wonderful. Anything, as long as we connect it with Krishna, is wonderful. And anything when we're disconnecting it from Krishna is not wonderful. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you can chant the holy name and it's just the alphabet. Prabhupada said, if you're chanting mechanically, thinking of material things, your chanting is useless. So it depends on our consciousness and our intent. And therefore we have these kind of statements that the Mahabharata, if you don't see the connection with Krishna, if you're not seeing it all as part of Krishna's story, then the benefit is very slight. And Vidura wanted something that was more obviously connected with Krishna, because whole parts of the Mahabharata are not so obviously connected with Krishna. It's just like anything else. You know, if you're going to work in at a financial investment company, it's not so obviously connected with Krishna. And you might prefer to have some time when you're sitting in Bhagavatam class where it's obviously connected with Krishna, although both can be connected or disconnected depending on your mentality. Kandita, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes. Hi, Krishna Prabhu. I just thought it was wonderful and perfect thing that you said about how do we know that these fantastical things or these pastimes of Lord Krishna are not mythology? And you said that it is by direct experience. And that's just a wonderful statement of explanation. I remember when I was taking a philosophy class in college, and the professor, we went through a book through all Western philosophy, and we went through, Aristotle and Aquinas and Kant, and one by one, and they were trying to present how can we prove the existence of God. And one by one, we came to the point where it was really impossible to actually prove the existence of God. And actually, one Christian in the class, he became so angry and so upset because his faith was challenged. Mm. This professor was actually trying to get everyone to not only think, but practically to become atheists.
Wow.
And this poor fellow, he stood up and he pointed a finger at the professor and he started yelling. He said, sometimes Satan is in certain places and I'm looking at Satan right now. And he pointed, jabbed his finger at the professor, grabbed his book, stomped out, and slammed the door behind him. And this was in the middle of the semester, and of course he got an F. And so I was thinking about it, I know that God exists, and I know that Krishna exists, and what is the proof? How can we prove that? And then I came to the conclusion that just like when we experience love, if we love our child or we love our husband or wife, other people might not experience that love, but we have had direct experience of that. We know that love exists, and love is not quantifiable scientifically by measurement or visually or anything. There's no scientific explanation for it, but we know personally it exists. We know that, I love this person. And so this is direct experience. And maybe that can be proven to everybody, but we have had personal direct experience with that. So I just thought it was wonderful because that is the answer. We're not just following by blind faith. We have faith in Krishna and the philosophy and our spiritual master because of our direct experience with Krishna and personal realizations and feelings. So I guess atheists or whoever, they haven't experienced it, and so therefore they condemn the existence of God. They say it can't be proven, but we know that he exists, and that was just such a wonderful statement. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. So that is the only ultimate proof. You can talk about evidence, Yeah. You can say that there's a lot of evidence for the existence of God. And there certainly is. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of evidence for the existence of God. And the only contradictory evidence is that we don't see him with our eyes like we see everybody else. And that there's so much evil and suffering in the world that we can't explain. Which wouldn't, by the way, say that there's no God, but it might speak to the character of God. And those are really the only evidences in favor of atheism. You know, that if there is a God, maybe he's not so nice, just whimsically causing people suffering. And if there is a God, why can't we see him? Which is a really kind of strange argument, because I've never seen the President of the United States either. So, in fact, I haven't even seen the mayor of Hilo. What to speak of any, you know, I haven't seen the president of Sears. So many people I haven't seen. But just the evidences alone are not enough to give us faith. They're enough to give us faith in the beginning. I mean, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti means that one is doing Sadhana Bhakti based on Vidhi. One is doing Sadhana Bhakti based on one's faith in logic, faith in the guru. If somebody comes and says, I have an experience, and we trust that person. We may not have much of an experience ourselves, but we trust that that person says they have an experience. And we have faith in the Shastra, and we have faith in logic. But even at that stage, to really start Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, Rupa Goswami says you have to have some taste, which speaks to some experience. So even in the beginning, one will have some experience. I mean, I just remember in some place in Europe, I think it was in Slovakia, and there was a couple that were very new to Krishna consciousness. And the gentleman said, chanting Hare Krishna is thousands of times better than sex. That was his direct experience. I remember this one man stopping by in Germany when we were having a program there. Again, just brand new, first time in a Hare Krishna temple. After 4 days, he said, let me try chanting. And he came back to the temple and he said, wow, this should be a controlled substance. So that's an experience even of a beginner. It may be in a basa, whatever, but it's some direct experience. And that it's only that direct experience which is really a proof. And as you say, it's a proof for me. It's a proof for you only if you believe me. And so that requires some sort of faith-based, you know, that's a little different. That I believe that Srila Prabhupada had an experience, or I believe that you had an experience. But that's more evidence. And the only way to get the proof is to have the experience, and the only way to have the experience is to jump. Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you.
PJ.